rumors of this. Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order. We're going to do our best to get through what appears to be a very busy agenda today and start by reopening the public hearing on House Bill 3039. You'll recall we had a few people who didn't get a chance to testify on Tuesday, so we're going to try and get through that very quickly. We have two other bills and a report to hear, so call Duke Shepherd, Brent Gunderson, and Jeff Bissonette forward. And as you are starting to get settled, I'm going to ask you each to see if you can do it in 2 minutes or less. Does that work?
Oh yeah.
Very good. And recognizing as you're also getting settled that it's far from the end of the conversation on this, so I appreciate having your comments now, and the work will continue. So go ahead, please.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I am actually here today on behalf of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48, which is one of our affiliates. Joe Esmond had planned to be here, but he's sick, and just asked me to say the IBEW supports this bill. It's good for bringing the jobs related to the implementation of the RPS. And good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brent Gunderson. I'm the president of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I've been in the solar industry in the state since 1981, when my mom thought I was crazy. And look where it's gotten us today. We're on the road to some great developments and things to come. Thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 3039 today. I've owned and operated a company called GenCon Incorporated since 1988. Here in the state, we've designed and installed and serviced solar energy systems throughout the Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Idaho. We are based in Portland, Oregon, and our clients range from homeowners all the way up to municipalities, where we've done solar pool heating systems for city pools. I'm here today on behalf of the Solar Energy Industries Association, which is the leading voice for the solar industry here in the state of Oregon. When I launched my company 20 years ago, the industry was just coming back, just beginning to come back. We were about 15 to 20 full-time companies in the state, and that was statewide, which was really more like two per city at best. There were no manufacturers in this state, no suppliers. Basically, we were just kind of hanging on to the development of solar energy and showing that it does work in this state and in the Northwest. We wouldn't have imagined today that where the industry is, with large brand name manufacturers coming to this state to build their solar panels and widgets and sell them nationwide and worldwide. When we look at the Betsy tax credits and the reports from the Econ Northwest study, that solar has some of the greatest expanses in job growth and development in the state, that really, again, we need to look at the bigger, longer-term picture than just a current snapshot of today. Oregon has demonstrated its commitment to the investment in the development of solar energy, and you prove that way back in the earliest of 80s. And these developments are now beginning to continue to pay dividends, and we don't want to cash that out now. We need to continue this because the investments are getting larger, and the dividends are getting larger to the state and its citizens.
Mr. Gibson, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm really trying to stick. So if you could wrap up, I'd really appreciate it.
I'm sorry. So basically what it comes down to is 3039 is going to employ quite a few employees in this state in the development and deployment of solar technologies throughout the state. So I would ask that you support this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bissonette.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers. We bow to no one in our respect for solar. We work in coalition with the solar industry all the time. We do have some concerns about this bill. It's a little bit more directive than earlier versions that we saw. We do have some concerns about the impacts on rates. We do have some concerns about the impacts on the new renewable portfolio standard. We agree with the previous speaker about job creation. However, economic development is not the role of rates. And so we just want to make sure that we're in line with everything. And so we think that and we understand that there's conversations to be had. We're happy to be part of those discussions, and we hope to be coming back to you with a proposal that we are in full support of, and we're looking forward to that discussion.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all being very very brief as well. Are there any quick questions for this panel, recognizing that conversations that have been mentioned are ongoing, and we're hopeful that we'll see improvements and amendments and so on very shortly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
She's here to speak on behalf of this bill as well. We haven't had the time. Jennifer Gleason.
I'm Barbara's mentioning that we have some written testimony from Jennifer Gleason, so that should be in front of you as well, and we'll note that for the record. Thank you very much. With that, I think we've completed the list of folks who wanted to testify on House Bill 3039, so we appreciate that, and close the public hearing on House Bill 3039, and open public hearing on House Bill 3027. While we're waiting for the chief sponsor to arrive, Barbara, hopefully you can give us a summary, please.
House Bill 3027 prohibits discrimination in real property transactions based on a person receiving federal rent subsidy payments and other local, state, or federal housing assistance. Allows person to consider a sufficiency of income in rental or real property.
Thank you. I'm hoping that Representative Kotek is on her way. Representative Garrard, thank you for your patience. I expect we'd like to hear from you at the same time as or slightly after Representative Kotek. So if you'd like to come up and join us up here. I keep waiting for the door to open. Here she is. Welcome, Representative Kotek. We just heard a summary of the bill and eager to hear further explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for waiting for me. I was just next door. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today to present House Bill 3027. With my good colleague from Klamath Falls, the good Representative Garrard. And this bill, as you probably heard in the summary, House Bill 3027 would close a loophole in Oregon law that currently allows discrimination against individuals who receive federal housing assistance. For many years, Oregon law has prohibited discrimination against renters based on their source of income, except if that source of income is a federal housing assistance voucher. This exception is unjust, it's bad public policy, and should be corrected. The Housing Choice Voucher Program, sometimes referred to as the Section 8 Voucher Program after the section of the U.S. Housing Act that authorizes it, is the largest federal housing assistance program in the country, bringing millions of federal dollars into our communities every year. The program is administered through local housing authorities and helps thousands of low-income Oregonians gain access to affordable housing. Portable vouchers are widely considered to be the most effective and low-cost approach to expanding affordable housing in desirable neighborhoods. Unfortunately, the success of this policy and program is limited by landlord discrimination against families who use these vouchers. Oregon law currently allows discrimination against low-income Oregonians by failing to recognize a Section 8 voucher as a legitimate resource for obtaining rental housing. It does this despite the fact that these housing vouchers are a reliable and legal source of payment which cannot be used for anything other than rent. This fact makes vouchers an extremely dependable source of income that landlords can count on from month to month. Despite this, recipients of housing vouchers are routinely and arbitrarily deemed ineligible for the very housing that the program was designed to help them obtain. The end result is the over-concentration of low-income and minority individuals in substandard housing and unsafe neighborhoods. House Bill 3027 would both protect low-income Oregonians from discrimination and help to prevent segregation based on socioeconomic status. Under this bill, landlords would still be permitted to screen and deny applicants based on past behavior or creditworthiness. Landlords would still be able to screen and deny applicants for insufficient income. And landlords would still be able to evict any tenant for failure to pay rent or for violations of the rental agreement. Landlords would just simply not be permitted to deny someone merely because they have a Section 8 voucher. House Bill 3027 has a very simple goal: to provide an individual or a family with a housing voucher the fullest range of choices when deciding where to live. This would allow parents to move somewhere so they can have their child go to the school, a good school of their choice. Perhaps an individual with a disability would have a shorter commute by bus because they're closer to their place of employment. And low-income families would be more likely to live in mixed-income neighborhoods, allowing them the benefits of the safety and services that go along with those better neighborhoods. This bill is ultimately about fairness. This is why 11 states and the District of Columbia already have statutes prohibiting discrimination against voucher holders. It's time for Oregon to join them. You're going to hear testimony today that will shed further light on the injustice that the current law allows and the damage it does not only to our low-income constituents, but to our communities as a whole. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I urge your due pass recommendation of House Bill 3027.
Thank you, Representative Cote. Representative Garak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sitting here with Representative Kotek, we're kind of like the odd couple in that she represents Portland and the metropolitan area, and I represent Klamath Falls, the other end of the state, and the more rural end of Oregon. But you see, it's a great combination because the same problem exists in both of our communities. Klamath Falls is one of Oregon's poorest communities. The average family income in Klamath Falls is slightly above $35,000 a year. And the number one problem we have in our community right now is that families can't afford shelter. They can't afford to find a place to rent. Rents are simply too high. My community, to be honest, is hurting. A survey in my local paper showed over 200 families homeless in Klamath Falls. It was 17 degrees there last night. It's not a wonderful sight. And as a, you know, we as state representatives feel we're leaders in our community. I felt that I had an obligation to do something as a community leader for this portion of my constituents. This bill will help not only poor people, but it will help people, medium-income people in my district. The story could be said of many other areas, from Medford to Klamath Falls to Pendleton to Portland to Eugene. This is simply a small step forward. It doesn't create a new tax. This bill doesn't create a new fee. But what it does create for many families will be hope. We hope that you'll pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions for either of our colleagues? Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of you, do you know why the original exception was made? Why is this here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I do not. I don't know the history. It has been on the books for a while, is my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for getting us started. We have a long list of people who would like to be testified, and as I have mentioned and will continue to mention, we've got a number of other things on our agenda today, so I'm going to be forced to limit our testimony to 2 minutes per person. Feel free, if someone before you has said what you're going to say, you need not repeat it. You can say, I agree with whomever that person was. And to get us started, Norton Cabell, I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, Deborah Imsey, and Robert Leith, L-E-I-T-H, I think. So I'm going to be I'm going to be very harsh on the clock in order to keep us on schedule. So you've got to watch, too. I like that. Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Representative Reed and members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I'm the legislative director for Oregon Rental Housing Association. We're a landlord trade group representing about 5,000 landlords around the state. And generally, we support Section 8, but we oppose mandating acceptance of Section 8, which this bill would do. And we do it for the following reasons. First, passage of this bill won't increase affordable housing for low-income Oregonians. Section 8 vouchers are all used. None go to waste. For a variety of reasons, like bad credit and prior evictions and criminal records, some individual voucher holders can't find housing, but all vouchers get used. In Lane County, for example, the waiting list has been closed for 4 years. That's how many people are waiting to get vouchers. Two, the Section 8 costs a landlord money. Housing authorities can limit rent increases and security deposits. The unit has to be vacant before they'll inspect. I could go on and on, but there are costs to landlords of participating in the Section 8 program. Third, the program is particularly burdensome on small landlords. Oregon's housing authorities have done a great job to make the program user-friendly, but they still have to comply with HUD regulations. A landlord with just one or two or even a handful of rental units is rarely to get a Section 8 applicant. That landlord is faced with understanding a bunch of paperwork and then signing a daunting contract with the housing authority. Delays while providing missing information or redoing forms can cost that landlord money because of time and delays. Two-thirds of our members have six or fewer rental units, so they are really impacted by this. Fourth, Section 8 is a program, not just a subsidy. Landlords are required to enter into a non-negotiable, HUD-dictated, 10-page contract with a housing authority. I attached a copy to my my testimony to you. Other agencies sometimes help tenants with rent, but they just send a check. Section 8 is a program. It's a successful program, but HUD recognized decades ago that forcing landlords to participate was counterproductive, and they changed their rules to allow landlords to limit their participation. We should not go back in time. Partnerships only work when both parties are willing. This is a well-intentioned bill. But landlords will find ways to not to participate if they so choose, such as requiring increased deposits or more income, and that will reduce housing options for many renters, especially low-income renters. I urge you to vote against HB 3027.
Thank you very much. I'll let you go a little over.
Thank you.
Ms. Imsi, please.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Imsi, and I am the Executive Director for Metro Multifamily Housing Association. Our members own or manage 150,000 units in the state of Oregon, many of whom participate in the Section 8 program. The goal of increasing the number of individuals and families that have access to affordable housing is one that my members share. However, we do not believe that this bill will increase access to affordable housing. What it will do is change Section 8 from a voluntary program to a mandatory one. Although the bill's sponsor does not intend for the bill to make Section 8 a protected class, that is, in fact, what it does. Under state fair housing law, a landlord can't consider certain characteristics when making a rental decision, including race, religion, and gender among those categories. Source of income has been included to the extent that the applicant's income is from a legal source and is verifiable. Landlords should not care where the rent money comes from, as long as the source is steady and legal. However, Section 8 has specifically not been included because it is more than just a source of income. It is a program with burdensome requirements imposed on the landlords who participate. The strings attached to the rent check are much different with Section 8 than any other source of income a tenant uses to pay their rent. HB 3027 adds Section 8 to the protected source of income classification. This means the landlord could no longer consider the applicant's Section 8 participation when making a rental decision. To treat all applicants fairly, landlords are trained to rent to the first qualified applicant who comes along. They don't pick and choose between qualified applicants in order to avoid any appearance of impropriety. The result of this bill will be to require a landlord to participate in the Section 8 program if the first applicant who passes all other criteria is a Section 8 participant.
And Ms. Imsi, that's 2 minutes if you're about
okay.
ready to wrap up,
and
please.
the full opinion from counsel, our counsel is attached to the written testimony. MMHA urges you to oppose HB 3027.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lee.
Hello, my name's Robert Leith. I'm a small-time landlord in Portland, Oregon. I'm a Democrat. And why I'm opposed to this bill is because in the past I've had Section 8 tenants, and as has been said before, it's very burdensome. We've had tenants, we've waited nearly a month for inspections, the paperwork, and then the tenants back out on the deal. I'm out. Like this one tenant, almost a month of rent or playing games to get the paperwork filled out. So this will be an extra burden on landlords. What landlords will start to do is raise deposits, raise rents, require higher FICO scores, and what this will in effect do is take the people that are just under Section 8 guidelines, and we as landlords will be raising the rents. It will be harder for the working poor in this state to qualify for a rental. They will be the ones that will basically bear the burden of this. As landlords, we never seem to really bear the burden of anything. It's always our customer, the tenant, and the working class in Oregon that are don't qualify for Section 8 will find out that they will be paying far more in rent, as will everybody. But they will especially disproportionately fall upon the working or the lower middle class. And I urge you to oppose this bill.
Thank you very much. Next on our list, Cliff Hockley, Larry Bricker, Bob Estabrook. See Mr. Estabrook, so we'll go for another name, Carolyn Matei. Go ahead, please.
Okay. At your read, members of the committee, my name is Larry Bricker. I'm employed with American Property Management in Portland, and I'm a member of Metro Multifamily Housing Association and representing them today. American Property Management is a Section 8 housing provider. We have over 100 Section 8 tenancies with our company, and Metro Multifamily Housing provides many more as well. So we are supportive of the successful voluntary partnership program that Section 8 is between landlords and the housing authorities. We are, however, we would oppose this bill because, again, it would make it a mandatory program rather than the voluntary partnership. As was mentioned earlier, 100% of vouchers are utilized. The issue at hand, I believe, is that some individual voucher holders are not able to find housing with their voucher, and I think that's why we're here. The perspective I wanted to add is in Portland, City Commissioner Nick Fish has convened a task force to look into ways to overcome barriers that Section 8 tenants are having finding housing. I am participating on that task force and just wanted to give a perspective. I'm not representing the task force or the commissioner, but my perspective is that the task force is looking at ways to provide incentives for landlords to participate, as again opposed to making it mandatory. An example of what's being looked at is a risk or a damage mitigation fund. One of the primary concerns landlords have are damages that are caused by any tenant. But in the case of a Section 8 tenant where resources are by definition an issue, after move-out damages beyond the security deposit really are unable to be paid. So this mitigation fund is something that's being looked at, an incentive to overcome an objection that landlords have. A second perspective being looked at in this task force is the issue of the Section 8 voucher holders that are unable to use their voucher. In many cases, it's because of rental qualifications that they might have. Just like any renter in the marketplace, some have some background issues with criminal background, credit, rental history, whatever it might be. In the marketplace, a survey, a sample of 15,000 applicants was done by a credit screening company, and they came up with 19.1% of applicants were denied, and that's just the general marketplace statistic. The Housing Authority of Portland that I am familiar with and work with similarly looks at about 20% of their clients have these barriers with their background. So the emphasis I would think needs to be looked at is that partners and the social service agencies come alongside, try to overcome these barriers that they have, and help find them housing. Again, it's these barriers with their background as opposed to a lack of housing that they're having the difficulty finding housing with in many cases. So, again, with this effort underway in Portland and the incentives that are coming forward, we would encourage a no vote on this bill and looking further into the partnership and the incentives with landlords.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify regarding House Bill 3027. My name is Cliff Hockley. I'm from Multnomah County, president of Bluestone and Hockley Real Estate Services. I'm a certified property manager and a member of the Metro Malta Family Housing Group. We manage over 6,000 units in Portland. Our company was founded in 72, and I've been there since 1986. At first glance, HB 3027 appears to support affordable housing goals. Unfortunately, it puts the landlords in the position of being forced to participate in the often challenging Section 8 program. We're staunch followers of federal fair housing practices. It means we get to screen our tenants on a first-come, first-served basis. If you qualify, you get the apartment or house. You have to have three times your portion of the rent in income, a good rental history, no collections except we're flexible on medical issues, no past evictions, no felonies, and have the ability to pay the rent. Section 8 voucher tenants need to provide a voucher at the time of application. If HB 3027 becomes law, it would require all rental owners to participate in the Section 8 program. Section 8 also limits the ability of landlords to recover their operating costs via rent increases. Section 8 guidelines limit or deny rental increases and damage recoveries to landlords. Even though water, garbage, utilities, taxes, insurance bills increase every year without fail, Section 8 program has significant limitations. We're opposed to mandating the acceptance of Section 8 tenancies. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Carolyn Maffei. I am the legislation chair with the Institute of Real Estate Management and a portfolio manager at CNR Real Estate Services that support the goal of increasing the participation in Section 8 voucher program. However, we oppose HB 3027 because it will force landlords to participate in Section 8, a currently volunteer program. First, Section 8 requires a year-long lease with its own terms and conditions, regardless of the policies of landlord and having them in place. Many landlords prefer month-to-month leases and do not want to have different policies for different tenancies, since that would be discriminatory in itself. Second, it takes at least 1 month to process a Section 8 voucher holder and approve an apartment for tenancy, according to the Housing Authority of Portland. This delay in having an apartment unrented results in a loss of rental income for the landlord each time a Section 8 tenant is accepted. There's also an extra cost in preparing all the documents required by Section 8. Lastly, it has been suggested that HB 3027 will only require landlords to take Section 8 applications, but not require landlords actual participation in Section 8. But that's not how it works. To follow federal fair housing practices, we accept the first applicant that passes a background check, has a good rental history, and can pay the rent. If the first application that I receive is from Section 8 voucher holder, then I have to take that applicant and participate in Section 8. I cannot simply pick and choose among several applicants and decide which one I like best or if I want to participate in Section 8. To do so would risk discrimination lawsuits.
Ms. Maffei, we're just coming up on 2 minutes, so if you could please wrap up.
Section 8 is a complex, expensive program that should remain voluntary. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you very much. I apologize for mispronouncing your name. They looked like T's on the sign-up sheet. Charlene Trexler, Phil Anderson, Joy, I think, Valine.
Mr. Chair, they're coming up and ask you a question.
Yes, please.
Are we anticipating written or oral testimony from anybody on the aforementioned task force in Portland, Nick Fish's task force?
No one has indicated that on the sign-up sheet. And I'm looking at Barbara.
No, we have not heard.
Because I know Nick Fish, I'll initiate, if you don't mind,
that's fine.
Some communication between. I'd love to know more about what they're doing for our committee.
Yeah, thank you. Please go ahead.
Yes, my name is Phil Anderson, small operator in South Salem, have a few units and small units, and we have been in business for about 18, 19 years. Always used month-to-month rental agreements. They work very successfully for us. They're a minimum of effort on our part. We're a small outfit. My wife does the books, and we do the work to try and maintain a nice, quiet place for people to live. And so we basically are opposing having to be involved in a program that is more paperwork, more effort, more time on our part when it's already tough enough to keep up with all the regulations that we have and making sure that we provide a nice, quiet place for people to live. A few years back, a partner and I bought a house and had it for rent. It sat vacant for 2 or 3 months. And we had a lady come to us who had a voucher, didn't tell us ahead of time. We show her through the unit. She falls in love with the house and then says, oh, by the way, you do accept a coupon. And we're going, well, no, we don't. But she loved the place, so we thought we'd go through the effort of looking at the program. And when she whipped out all the paperwork and all the things that were involved, we said, whoa, we're not equipped for this. This is not for us. And so we basically chose to have our unit sitting vacant rather than take on the extra effort that it takes to do all that paperwork, wait for the inspections, do all those things. So like I say, it's been very effective for us to stay on a month-to-month tenancy. And, we try to provide a good service for people, and we think that being able to have that free choice to decide whether, you know, we're not against people having that program. We're not against the people that do leases. They're very well equipped for that, but we're small. We're not equipped for the handling that. So we'd appreciate if that was, we still had the opportunity of choice in our behalf. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead. Trevor, if you'd like to go next.
Sure. Go ahead. My name is Joy Valine. I reside as a tenant in an apartment building in Northeast Portland. I am employed as an administrative assistant to a businessman who also owns rental properties. I'm opposed to HB 3027 that requires landlords to accept Section 8 clients. We currently have residents who are Section 8 clients. It's a good program, but I do have concerns about this bill. Section 8 currently requires use of a 12-month lease for the initial rental period. We rent on a month-to-month basis, as is common with many landlords. Accepting a Section 8 client requires us to change our rental procedures. We have one Section 8 client who's been a resident since September of 2003. As she will readily admit, she's made some bad lifestyle choices in the past. We took a chance on her because at the time we accepted her as a Section 8 client, we were able to rent to her on a month-to-month basis rather than a one-year lease. She has worked as a tenant, though there has been some bumps in the road. This might sound like an argument in favor of landlords being required to accept Section 8 clients, but it's quite the opposite. With a Section 8 client, a landlord can only give a for-cause notice to terminate the tenancy in the first year. Noise, being rude, obnoxious to neighbors, not following parking rules, these are very annoying things to other residents, but often are not things that would support a for-cause termination. It is hard to say to the other residents, we tried, sorry, we can't do much about it. Landlords who might accept a Section 8 client on a month-to-month basis often don't want to take a chance on someone that they will essentially be married to for 12 months. I have taken applications from a number of Section 8 clients and rejected their applications because I was unable to get a good reference from a current or past landlord. The Section 8 client left out the request for information about criminal history, or the Section 8 client tried to get us to violate the Section 8 contract by allowing people other than the person authorized by Section 8 to live in the unit.
Ms. Willing, that's 2 minutes. If you
okay.
Wrap up, please.
Oh, my final thing is it opens up the landlords to more possibility of being faced with a discrimination claim and related defense costs.
I appreciate your last comment. As I read the bill, it doesn't require anyone to accept, but merely prohibits the discrimination. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Charlene Trexler. I live in Staten, Oregon. I have rental property in the Santa Ym Canyon, but I earn most of my money as a Christmas tree farmer and a licensed general contractor. I'm here to ask you not to approve House Bill 3027. I have worked with Marion County Housing for the past 15 years and currently have three houses with the Section 8 program. I'm not opposed to the program, but I have found that it's impacted me in some negative ways. I understand the purpose of the bill is to give some renters some additional choices for homes, but it will impose a significant hardship on me if it passes. For example, because of the economy, I currently have homes that I'll be listing for sale. If this law passes, I'd be forced to rent to them on a 12-month lease. Any potential buyers for that home won't even look at the home or walk through if they know they can't move in for a year. There are so few buyers right now that my only alternative would be to leave the house vacant at a cost of about $1,500 a month. According to my agent, that any house right now listed might take 8 months to sell, so potentially that could cost me $10,000 or $15,000 in mortgage payments by leaving that house vacant. If I lost my job and I could not make the mortgage payments, I would have to sell my rental, and if I could not sell until the end of the housing contract, I may be forced into foreclosure and lose the home and have no way of curing the foreclosure. In addition, in the past, if I had to raise rent because of overhead increases beyond my control, I was able to give a 30-day notice to my month-to-month tenants and raise rent. On one house with housing, I had to wait 10 months to increase the rent $30, and during that entire time, of course, it's a negative cash flow for me. And I don't think it's fair that I should be able to be forced to have a negative cash flow.
That might be a good place to stop for 2 minutes.
Okay. I'm just asking you to vote no on House Bill 3027.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next on our list, Jim Herman, Klaus Gibson, and Kevin Finney. I apologize again for having to be so quick. We got a lot of people to get through. Thanks for your understanding. Go ahead, please.
My name is Jim Herman, and I'm a small landlord in the Portland area. And many times, it seems like small landlords are on the menu here down in Salem. And Section 8 is particularly problematic for small landlords. I would hate to say that they chisel me, but they certainly have shorted me in the past. And it's been problematic enough so that I don't accept Section 8 anymore. Well, currently, when tenants are calling me on the phone looking for property, they don't ask if I accept Section 8, but they do ask what my criteria is. Is it 2 times monthly rent for income or 3 times? When I tell them it's 3 times, they hang up. Now, say this passes, and everyone, like some of the last people have mentioned, raises their criteria. Pardon me. Say they raise their criteria. What's going to happen to all those people that are not privy to Section 8 program? Anyway, I'm just asking you to not implement this program. Oh, one last thing. When you raise this to level of discrimination, any complaint that you get against you, it costs at least $2,000 just to file a rebuttal, and it goes up from there. It's only going to be problematic for small landlords.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir?
My name is Klaus Gibson. I'm a small property owner. I own 4 duplexes in Gresham, and I rent my properties with a month-to-month rental agreement. And I think that I'm opposed to this bill. I think with mandatory Section 8, I think one should be very careful with what one wishes for, because I think that this law will negatively impact investment in rental housing, and the less rental property there is available, the higher the cost of rent is, resulting in more people having to spend more disposable income for housing. I think this bill is a false step forward that hurts working Oregonians, and I urge you to vote no on House Bill 3027. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Finney.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Finney. I'm here representing Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, Association of 17 Christian denominations, many congregations, and interreligious organizations. We operate several direct service programs for low-income Oregonians, including a shared housing program and the Patton Home in North Portland, providing a specialized drug and alcohol-free population, a neighborhood single-room occupancy facility. I want to make 2 points. First of all, 40 years ago, most public housing was provided through public housing authorities that operated publicly owned housing projects. Since that time, low-income housing support has evolved to rely primarily on privately owned rental units utilizing partial rental assistance vouchers issued today primarily under the Housing Choice Voucher Program. A primary goal of this program is to encourage low-income families in obtaining housing outside areas of high poverty concentration. There are many important benefits that flow from this. HUD-sponsored research has shown that families with children moving from communities of high poverty concentration into communities of low poverty concentration perform better in school. Dropout rates are lower, graduation rates are higher, and college attendance rates are higher. Families also report benefiting from lower crime rates and increased employment opportunities. For these reasons and other important reasons, it's essential that recipients of Section 8 vouchers not be blocked from entering low-poverty communities due to discrimination by landlords. That's why Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon supports this bill and urges you to give it a two-pass recommendation.
It's a great place to stop if it's good for you. You're right at 2 minutes.
I got one little anecdote.
Okay, go ahead, quickly, please.
And then I'm done. I just want to share with you that as I was discussing this with the chair of our Public Policy Committee, who is a deacon in the Dalles, he told me that his parents are in a retirement complex there where they've lived for 10 years, never been late on their rent payments, and kept their unit in immaculate condition. However, recently they've seen their retirement savings decline. They're now eligible for Section 8 vouchers, but they've been told that their unit does not accept them and they will not be able to use Section 8 vouchers. So Section 8 discrimination does exist here, and in his words, this is not fair and it's not legal. I urge you to pass, and it should not be legal. I urge you to pass 3027.
Thank you, Mr. Finney.
Thank you.
Matthew Gill, Nancy McKay, and Elisa Alguera. I hope I've read those correctly.
Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you, committee members, for letting me come down and speak. Chair Reed, my name is Elisa Aguilar. I'm one of the co-directors for the Community Alliance of Tenants. We're a statewide tenants' rights organization that provides a hotline, the only hotline, tenants' rights hotline in the state of Oregon. We are in full support of House Bill 3027. CAT is a grassroots tenants' rights organization primarily made up of membership of low-income tenants. We have a number of landlords and housing providers who are also supporters of our organization. The majority of our constituents pay anywhere between 50% to 70% of their income on rent. Paying that much money from your own income on rent leaves it really unstable for you to be able to provide on a consistent basis food anytime any medical emergency comes up or something else comes up, like if a car breaks down or anything. The main points that I would like to share is that this bill, Section 8 vouchers, provide a stabilization opportunity. It's a legit means of income and assistance for residents. Allowing the discrimination of not letting people take the Section 8 vouchers kind of is just another stigma denying people housing. In Portland metro area, we have about a 40% return rate of Section 8 vouchers. So people who are given the opportunity to be able to have the Section 8 voucher stabilize their housing by only having to pay about 30% of their income, 40% of them have to return it and face the edge of homelessness. Many of CAT's board members and constituents in the past have had to face homelessness because of being denied housing. Again, we represent a number of tenants. clients throughout the state of Oregon. This is not just a Portland issue that can be dealt with in one task force in Portland. This is a statewide issue that affects constituents through all of your areas.
And that's 2 minutes, actually.
All right. Can I just...
Very quickly.
So, in order to succeed in life, children need a safe place to call home. The Section 8 voucher program allows that. Landlords will still have the opportunity to screen and screen out tenants and have eviction protections as stated in the bill. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Hi, my name is Nancy McKay, and I'm a volunteer with CAT, Community Alliance of Tenants, but I'm here for a more of a personal reason, a couple of experiences that I would like to share. In trying to help my son obtain renting this summer, I had the rather unpleasant experience of talking to different prospective landlords and having them pose the question about Section 8, not even knowing what it was, and my son didn't have it. But it made it very clear that they wouldn't even talk to us if we happened to be with that program. I found this pretty upsetting, and in fact, it led me to get involved with the Community Alliance of Tenants. But the sad bottom line here is that my son was denied living in different parts of town, the kind of standard of living that he was used to, because of this stigma that he wasn't even associated with. And the reason that I know this sounds a little bit contradictory, but what I'm getting at here is he ended up in a place, pretty horrible, but we were willing to settle for it because the unit was halfway decent. But when we came to move in, we were told that that unit was given to a Section 8 person because they had to pass certain inspection standards, and the unit they gave us was pretty horrible. And I'll tell you, that supports what I see from people that call in on the hotline. There is a need for these inspections, and the quality of life for so many people out there is absolutely unbelievable. Another thing I just want to say is that this has become a personal issue for me because after working for almost 30 years, I am now on Social Security disability, and my sole income now is Social Security disability, and I am now a candidate for Section 8. And I overheard one of the gentlemen say, I don't want any of those people in my facility. I'm one of those people now, and I've been a homeowner, a taxpayer. I've got excellent rent history. So I would like to do something, if I can, to dispel the stigma about people who have Section 8. And I'd like to, again, remind people that there are those other screening procedures that they have at their availability if they want to eliminate some people that they just find not good potential renters. Anyway, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. McKay. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Matthew Gill. I'm a small landowner or property owner. I own three duplexes and one single family home in Southeast Portland. I should say the bank owns them. My hope is that by the time I'm 65 years old, these properties will be paid for and provide me a retirement income. I'm very opposed to this bill. I don't need more regulations that will give tenants another opportunity to sue me or cause my properties to be vacant for up to a month at a time waiting for HUD inspectors to come and inspect the property. My wife and I both work full-time. We don't make any money on these houses yet. We hope to someday. And we work very, very hard to keep these properties in top condition. I think there are enough regulations now ensuring fair housing to tenants, and I don't think we need any more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chris Hermoski, I hope I'm getting that one right, to read. Sybil Hebb, Amber Fry, please. Please go ahead and get started.
Okay.
Pull that microphone over to you and
all right.
Go for it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hermoski. I am on the board of directors of Metro, which is the Multifamily Housing Council, but probably my unique perspective is that I'm involved in the management of single-family homes. I own a company called Mainlander Property Management. We manage about 1,100 homes. I checked just before I left the office or I came here. We have 12 that are under Section 8. We are opposed to the House Bill 3027 for several different reasons, and a lot of those reasons have been stated previously, and as you requested, I'm not going to go through all those, but I think as you go through and you look at the what the authors of the bill said, that this is a life-saving, and it's going to create an environment that's going to change things. I think that is taken out of context, and some of the things there aren't going to happen in the real world. And we need to look at that. I think that you mentioned yourself that there's the possibility that there's some things that won't be viewed as discriminatory if this bill passes. The not ever being in the state capitol building before and not ever coming to these kinds of things, I have to depend on what our associations tell us. Their legal counsel tells us that this will force us into a situation where we, as property managers taking care of other people's properties, have to look at these things and be aware as to whether or not this is going to be discriminatory. And by passing this bill, it puts us in that position. I think there's other ways that we can work through the situation and help the problem. And by doing this, this is going to limit what those options are. So I seriously challenge you to make sure that when you look at this, that you're taking all the facts in. And I, based on everything I've seen and what I've been doing, I oppose it. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I'm glad, even though you oppose the bill, I'm glad it caused you to come visit the Capitol. Ms. Hebb.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. I appreciate your attention to this issue. We are in support of House Bill 3027. I will let my colleague Amber Fry, who is a staff attorney doing housing work in the Lincoln County Legal Aid Office, speak more specifically. But from the Law Center's perspective, I would like to offer particular perspective on the policy underlying the bill. As previous witnesses have testified, we unfortunately find that often there are assumptions made about people who are low income that are based on stereotypes and are inaccurate, and those stereotypes can serve to perpetuate the cycle of poverty, which is our organization's goal to help people escape. I do understand and appreciate the concerns that the landlords have expressed with respect to some of the requirements of the program, but we would respectfully disagree about the balance of those considerations because we feel that the public policy underlying the bill is of greater importance. I would just want to offer, I think, a perspective on how this similar protection has been handled in other states. There are currently 8 states in the nation that have done what this bill proposes to do. Those protections have been in place in many instances for a number of years. And the earliest one that I know of is the state of Maine, where there has been this protection since 1973. What we hear from tenant advocates and from legal aid attorneys in those states is that the protections have served to help their clients and to help take care of and alleviate some of the discrimination that does exist. And so we would, from that experience, assume that this step, if taken in Oregon, would similarly serve to alleviate some of those burdens. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about the other statutes, but I'll turn the mic to my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you, Sid. Right.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thanks for hearing from me today. As Sybil's told you, I'm a legal aid attorney out in Lincoln County, Oregon. It's pretty rural out there. So as in other rural counties, there's a real shortage of available, decent, affordable housing for families. There's also a real shortage of landlords who will accept vouchers. So this means that for voucher holder families, there's a very limited number of housing opportunities available. Now, when you've got a Section 8 voucher, you've got a real limited amount of time to either find a place and use it or else you lose it. So when a family loses their voucher, they're losing the ability to find housing that they can afford. And while tenants can go back on a wait list, as others have said, that can be a lengthy process. Also, the limited number of residences available means that families who need to move face a lot of hardships. They've got to make difficult decisions about whether to take the first house that will take their voucher that comes along or to wait for another house that might be closer to work, that might be on a public bus line, that might be within the same school district, and gamble on losing their voucher. And I think as time goes by and landlords become more familiar with the paperwork, there's a lot of real pluses in this bill for them as well. Under the voucher program, tenants have to meet a lot of standards, and tenants who don't take care of the property or who become evicted face losing their voucher. Landlords can also count on the voucher portion of their rent being paid regularly, even if their tenant faces a financial setback like losing their job. And also, I think both landlords and tenants benefit from regular inspections because any problems that exist are caught and brought to people's attention and can be taken care of early. And also, there's a record created by a third party of the condition of the unit over the course of the tenancy. So just to draw things to a close, before I became an attorney, I worked in property management, and we did participate in the voucher program. And while working with the federal government can be difficult and problems can come up, I think housing authorities are willing to bend over backwards to work with landlords to create a program that works.
And that's a nice conclusion. Thank you very much. We have just a few more people. Dennis Chapa, Phil Donovan, Jerry Kraft or Croft? I can't tell from the...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
I think it'd be beneficial if Sybil maybe before she could give us a copy of the places that, or give us a list of the houses, or not the houses, but the states that have actually implemented this kind of policy.
If you could make that available to us, we'd appreciate it. Thanks very much. Gentlemen, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Dennis Chapa. I live in Eugene. I work full-time as a toned eye maker and supervisor. I'm a part-time landlord with 5 rental units. I'm here to ask you not to approve House Bill 3027. While I agree that Section 8 is a good program, my wife and I choose not to participate in it because of the added burden. When I am working evenings and weekends to prepare a unit to be re-rented, I do not want to spend additional time to meet Section 8 requirements. We only use month-to-month rental agreements because that provides us with the best flexibility to manage our units, and Section 8 requires yearly leases. If I were to lose my job, I would be forced to move out of the area because there are no other toolmaker jobs in my area, and that's why we try to keep the flexibility in having month-to-month leases in case we had to sell our property on a short notice. While HB 3027 may be well-intentioned, I don't feel it will increase affordable housing. Currently in Lane County, all the vouchers are used, so the problem is not availability of housing. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities, which is a statewide association. And as a statewide association, we've chosen to take no position on this bill. And the nuance and the reason for that is each housing authority director is going to weigh in with you directly. And frankly, you're going to hear mostly opposition to this legislation from your local housing authorities. But the situation is you've got this issue of Section 8 success rates impacting different housing markets in different ways. And as a result, our association couldn't find consensus. We do agree on a few values that I want to share with you. First off, we want to find the best way to increase renting options to Section 8 people. And that's why you see the Section 8 success rate task force that's taking place in the city of Portland right now. The Housing Authority of Portland is involved with that. Secondly, we appreciate our relationship with landlords and respect their rights as property owners. And it's been nice to hear the supportive comments that have been made from many of the landlords who are present today, but it's clear it's not a program for everyone. And so with that, I'll turn to Jerry Kraft, who's with the Salem Housing Authority.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Kraft, Executive Director of the Salem Housing Authority. What I'd like to say is that Salem Housing Authority is among those that housing authorities that is opposed to House Bill 3027. We certainly respect the sponsor's intent to promote housing opportunity, but in our opinion, the bill may hinder that opportunity. Salem Housing Authority offers rental assistance to 2,870 households through the voucher program in Salem and Kaiser, and all of those vouchers are in use, and the program is very well dispersed throughout our Salem and Kaiser communities. The Section 8 program is an excellent example of a public-private partnership that works very well in our community. We honor the landlord's ability to choose, and obviously as our partner, what's good for them is good for us and good for the Section 8 program. I'd like to cite a couple of adverse consequences for tenants and landlords if they must take the application but choose not to lease under the program. This will needlessly tie up the voucher holder. They typically have 60 days from the time they receive the voucher to come in with a lease. If they're tied up with a landlord who is not going to lease to them but who's considering an application, they're burning time on that 60 days. There may needlessly be some charge of application fees to that applicant with no intention to lease to them. That's expensive for that voucher applicant. And finally, there's increase to the potential liability from landlords, as has already been expressed. I can tell you that in Salem and Kaiser, we have no lack of landlords willing to participate. Of those 2,870 households we assist, we have 1,300 individual landlords that provide that housing. We have weekly rental listings that we maintain that are voluntarily populated by the landlords willing to rent to Section 8. They actually market to our Section 8 clientele. And currently this week, even in a tight rental market, I've got 144 listings of units available or about to be available from landlords willing to rent to Section 8.
That might be a good place to stop.
That's fine.
It's okay with you. Thank you very much.
Here.
Yes, sir.
Quick question for Phil.
Go ahead.
Phil, are you monitoring that or are you part of that task force? I noticed the reference to the Portland.
Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam. I think it's better to say that I'm monitoring it through the Housing Authority of Portland. I do know that right now the turnback rate was, I think, a bit exaggerated earlier in testimony. My understanding is it's right now running at about 75% rate turnback. With that, the negative thing that is 1 in 4 are going back. But to put it in context, the goal that they're trying to move to is 85%. So. And this is off of progress where it had been in years past as low in the 60% range. So there's been progress made in the city of Portland, and there is a goal of trying to get to 85%. Housing Authority of Portland is working towards that.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. One last person on our list, Bob Esterbrook. Being patient. You're batting cleanup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will definitely be brief. I know you've heard a lot about this bill. For the record, Bob Esterbrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Bowie's Civil Rights Division is the entity that enforces Oregon's fair housing law and federal fair housing law, and just wanted to briefly state our support for this expansion of the protection for Oregon renters getting the greatest possible access to housing, and also to say that the language of this bill is something that we contacted the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development about because we enforce a contract for HUD and wanted to make sure that this language wasn't going to create any difficulty in that contract, and there is none. So the Bureau is supportive of 3027.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Appreciate this, Mike. With that, unless there are any quick comments from the committee, I appreciate everyone's testimony. It's apparent there's a lot going on here, and I expect that conversation may continue. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3027 and open an informational meeting on the Enterprise Zone study that we heard something about this morning in the Revenue Committee. Hasn't. Thank you for being here. Please don't take anything by the fact that your approach to the dais is causing other people to leave the room.
No, Mr. Chair.
It's a nice quick transition here, too.
Nicely done. We'll allow for the room to clear. Economic development. Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And we're here today. I'm here with Art Ear from the Employment Department, the State Employment Economist, and Ed Waters, our consultant, to present to you the Enterprise Zone Study. More than half of the committee have heard it this morning, but it's a chance for you to give us more questions.
Not more than half, three, right? It's more than half of the committee present, I suppose.
Yes, yes, sir. That's the more precise definition of my statement. But
sorry, Mr. Chair.
And the important half, I might add, but I would like to request that you move the microphone a little bit closer. I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
Sure. Thank you.
So these are the microphones that are closer, not the...
it's hearing room aid that's a little farther away. Yes.
Just for you.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, we really appreciate that you take the time to hear our report in your committee. Earlier this morning, we had to present this report to the House Revenue Committee, and also we appreciate the interest within the legislative body. Next Tuesday, we will be presenting it to Representative Witt's committee, and also for the Senate Revenue Committee on next Tuesday.
Consider us another rehearsal.
Yes.
But probably well refined by the time you're finished, I'm sure.
This probably will be our finest performance, Mr. Chair, and we understand that the time is very tight. We only have an hour and 20 minutes, so we'll dispense with it. So, Mr. Chair, just to give you a quick brief on this, the 2000 session mandated the Legislative Revenue Office to, by Senate Bill 151, to study certain things, certain impacts of enterprise zones. It was interested to look at the effects of the property tax incentives on state and local economies, public finance, government services, all these be examined, and specified that the statistical analysis of the change in the measure of the community economic hardship over time for those local areas that have adopted enterprise zones that be conducted. The Legislative Revenue Office, what we've done is we put together a study review team of a number of people. We had Art Ayer, who's also sitting with us today, from the Employment Department, Tony Ruffalo from Portland State University, John Hart from the Department of Revenue, Doris Penwell from Association of Oregon Counties. She's also present in the room in case you need any questions answered. Hasina Squires from Special District Association. She's present here today with us as well. Andy Shaw, Willie Tiffany, and Michael Novak from the League of Oregon Cities. And finally, the review team worked with the Employment, Economic Development, Department of Economic and Community Development, with Art Fish, and we had really relied in a lot of our work on both the Employment Department. They have pulled a lot of work and a lot of data for us, and we are really especially in debt for their work to get this report to you. And likewise, that is the case for Community Development Department and Art Fish. And from this point, Mr. Chair, I just would like to bring it to your attention to the first of the report in front of you that we have as a research report from the Legislative Revenue Office. The highlights of our results are in the front. These are really interesting results that we find. They're probably an indicative type of results for further I'm not going to say further study, because you might take it seriously and pass a bill or so. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll start with Art, who has... Sure. I'm sorry. Ed will take the presentation with the PowerPoint and start discussing the study and its results with you.
Thank you, Mazen. Thank you. I would hope, I hate to do this, it's not simply because I heard some of this morning, but I'm worried about the clock and the bill that we have yet to hear. So please feel free to go more quickly in your highlights than you did this morning, and we'll ask questions.
Understood, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Ed Waters. I have a brief summary of Research Report 4-09. Basically, the project looked at benefits and costs of enterprise zone project or program. We used very simple methods to examine first-order measures of the benefits and costs of the programs. For benefits, we examined change in covered employment between 2003 and 2006. 2003 and 2006 being the earliest and most recent available years, respectively, where we had spatially specific or geocoded employment and payroll data. Also, we looked at census variables to examine benefits as broader socioeconomic effects over a longer period of time, that being 1990 to 2000. And finally, on the cost side, we used a data set produced by ArtFish at Oregon Economic and Community Development Department to extract estimates of property taxes foregone, post-property tax or post-exemption property tax collections, and the numbers of new jobs created in each enterprise zone project. We divided the pool of enterprise zones into five geographic strata based primarily on geography. Those are listed there on the slide and also in table three, I believe, in your report. Also, tables one and two show the specific enterprise zones that found their way into our short-term sample and our long-term sample. We used two samples because, again, we did the two different kinds of benefits analysis using, for the short-term sample, employment and payroll data, and for the long-term sample, census variables from the U.S. Census, 1990-2000 census. We also needed comparison areas as sort of a control group to do this study. Comparison areas were selected to represent conditions in non-enterprise zone areas in each of our sample strata. To determine candidates for possible matching as comparison areas, each census tract in the state was assigned to one of our strata based on the county it fell in, as shown in Table 3. And we used a statistical method, simple correlation factor, to match employment or industry employment profiles in comparison areas against industry employment profiles in the sample enterprise zones. And candidate areas which came closest to matching the industry employment profile were designated as comparison areas for each enterprise zone stratum. Methodology, very briefly, we analyzed short-term benefits by comparing change in private industry employment and payroll between the two points, 2003 and 2006, and then looking at that vis-a-vis what occurred in the comparison areas. For long-term benefits, we compared changes in a list of census variables in enterprise zones and compared that with the change in comparison areas between the years 1990 and 2000. And the specific variables we looked at were poverty rate, unemployment rate, household income, housing vacancy rate, and median gross rent. And then for analysis of costs, we used the OECD enterprise zone data set to calculate property taxes foregone per net job created, and also the number of years required to recover foregone property taxes. Jumping to results. Results of the short-term benefits analysis are shown beginning in Table 7, or Table 5 through Table 7 in the report. And that starts on page 7. Results of the short-term benefits analysis show that, you know, growth in employment and payroll by participating enterprise zone firms was considerably stronger than occurred in comparison areas. But there is really no discernible difference in growth between comparison areas and firms in enterprise zones that did not participate or receive tax exemptions. Enterprise zones in the rural east side stratum outperformed the comparison areas by the widest margin compared with the other strata. and growth in employment and payroll in rural remote enterprise zones was considerably less than observed in comparison areas. Also, growth in average pay for participating firms was less than in comparison areas for all in all strata except the urban metro stratum.
I hate to do it, but could I ask you to just really quickly hit the last couple of slides? I want to make sure that I give the committee just a chance to ask a quick couple of questions, and I really feel badly about doing it, but I want to make sure that that we give time to this last bill.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you very much.
Next, long-term benefits analysis. Detailed results of the long-term benefits analysis are found on tables 11 through 15. Summarize the change in poverty rates in enterprise zones versus comparison areas was very mixed, so hard to make conclusive statements about that. Unemployment declined more or rose less than in comparison areas everywhere except for the urban Western Valley enterprise zones. Changes in household income and household vacancy rates were also quite mixed. And lastly, median rent declined more than in comparison areas in only one stratum, that being the urban metro. The last set of results I have to report regarding the costs side of the story. These are found in tables 16 through 18 in the report. And these results show that about 7 years are required to recover the undiscounted value of enterprise zone property tax exemptions. The range is from 3 to 11 years, depending on stratum. Statewide, about $11,000 in property taxes are foregone per net full-time job created, with a range of from about $1,100 to $33,000 per job. But when you remove power generating and waiver projects from the data, this reduces the value of foregone property taxes for the rest of the projects to $7,800, with a range of from, again, about $1,100 up to $12,600 per job. I had some observations and recommendations for further work. I'll just hit the observations real quickly. It appears that 3 years, 2003 to 2006, was too short a period to really expect to see evidence of employment change in enterprise zones. However, that's what we were stuck with. that was the widest dispersion of the data that we had available with the spatially specific characteristics that we needed for this detailed of an analysis. Also, it appears that enterprise zones in the rural remote stratum were really not established long enough to expect to notice any long-term effects. That may change when and if we get the 2010 census data available in the next 3 or 4 years. Also, issues not addressed in this analysis include important things that people like to look at, like the effect of property tax shifting or effect on property tax shifting. Also, a present value type of analysis using discounted property tax exemptions and property tax collections. Also, effects on public finances, and also the big question of attribution of development impacts. Were these projects or exemptions necessary in order to stimulate the kinds of investments we saw?
Thank you very much. I apologize again for making you hustle through that. I know there's a lot more here. We've just sort of whetted our appetite, and others have said it. I really appreciate the extra effort you went to in generating this data. I think it's very appropriate for us to measure what we're doing to see if it's effective. Recognizing all that, are there any quick questions from the committee? Representative Holby?
I just have one. I don't know if I didn't catch why the short time period, 2003 to 2006, was used. Is that just because of the data availability or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that's correct. We needed data that had been geocoded, so it was specific to a particular area or a shape file in order to make sure we were counting or covering the whole enterprise zone area. And the earliest year that kind of data or that detailed data was available was 2003. And when we started the project last summer, the most recent year of available data was 2006. Although now I think 2007 has become available. So it takes time to put together data at that level of detail for doing geographic analysis.
Essentially, it's what data you had available. Is that right?
The project review team went back and forth over it a few times, and that's where we came down, in order to be able to get started when we wanted to and finish by March.
Seems like one clear conclusion is we have more to study, which should always make economists happy, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll follow up with them later to clarify that, because it seems like data is available on enterprise zones going much further back, so I'm not exactly sure what kind of data isn't available.
Well, and Representative Holby, thanks for making that point. I think I'm hopeful that as the committee schedule allows, following the deadlines we're operating under, perhaps we can have the gentleman back and have a more complete discussion.
Great.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being part of it. Representative Thatcher?
Oh, just for a question. Without lots of department vernacular, I'm wondering if you could just tell me, if you looked at how many jobs were created or businesses were created versus those that were promised.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I didn't look at that specifically. I think in many cases it would be possible, but a lot of the documentation, I think, is hard copy paper that may or may not be available for it when you go back in time and look at performance, you know, back into the early years of the program, for example. But I think maybe the Economic and Community Development Department people could tell us how possible it would be to do that sort of analysis.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I just think it's important because we need to know if these things are working. I mean, they sound great. Are they working? Are they really delivering what they promise?
Certainly the question we're endeavoring to find out. Hopefully we can have a further conversation with these
gentlemen. Right, in plain English, please.
It absolutely.
It's not vernacular.
Mr. Chair, if I may add quickly, in your page 16, table 16 also, 17 and 18, you have the number of jobs created in that area. And also what we would have, too, is how much did each job cost us in and adjusting for the cost of jobs. That's always been the question that we were eager to answer and to know. And that's where the amount of tax tax breaks going from the 11,000 to 3,000 someplace and other places of $33,000 per job. That's the issues that were always paramount and annoying.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. That will close the informational meeting on the Enterprise Zone Research Project and open a public hearing on House Bill 3095. Representative Hanna, Representative Freeman, please. While you're getting settled, Barbara, if you wouldn't mind giving us a summary, please.
HB 3095 creates an income tax credit for capital improvements to business facilities or homes that are commenced prior to September 1, 2009, or the effective date of this act, whichever is later. Defines capital improvement. Defines minimum and maximum amounts that can be claimed for the tax credit by both residences and businesses. Establishes requirements for certification of capital improvements. Applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Thank you. Let me, as you gentlemen get started, let me welcome Representative Barnhart, Chair of the Revenue Committee, who's joined us, and Senator Morse. I didn't welcome you for it, so glad you're here as well. Thank you all for your presence and your patience. Gentlemen can decide what's the appropriate order.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Reed. I greatly appreciate you hearing this bill. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Hanna, and I represent House District 7. My district includes Lane County with an unemployment rate in excess of 12% and Douglas County, which has an unemployment rate currently exceeding 18%, projected to be beyond 20%. I appreciate you taking time to consider House Bill 3095, known as the Main Street Incentive Plan. The Main Street Plan may be the smartest investment this legislature could make to promote economic security, improve our state's business environment, and provide hope for jobs to Oregonians. The Main Street Plan stimulates our economy by encouraging local businesses and homeowners to invest in improvements in their property using a tax credit. Under HB 3095, Oregonians would be able to claim 50% of the cost of their own capital construction project over a 5-year period. Property owners pursuing green projects or those that promote renewable energy alternatives would qualify for a 100% tax credit over that same five-year period, as would those projects making ADA compliance. The tax credit for property owners would only become effective after the projects are completed. The program would limit the amount of the credit to $5,000 to $50,000 for homeowners and $25,000 to $500,000 for business owners. In order for this process to quickly boost job creation, qualified projects must begin before September 1st, 2009. But given the late date of this hearing, I would be open to adjusting that date slightly. The Main Street Plan requires a short-term state investment, but it is a smart investment in putting people back to work. The plan would cost $45.6 million per year over 5 years. Yet 100% of the plan's costs would be applied to economic stimulus. None would go to state-administered overhead or state debt service. The Main Street Plan will boost economic development throughout the state because it gives thousands of Oregonians and Oregon businesses an important incentive to invest in new projects. These projects would increase the value of residential and commercial property throughout the state, consequently increasing property tax revenue for local governments. Many local businesses will benefit and be able to grow upon completion of these projects. For example, a retail shopping center with a new parking lot might attract new customers. A hotel with remodeled rooms may attract more visitors. In addition to benefits provided to property owners and local governments, the struggling financial sector would benefit as well. Property owners would be borrowing money, not the state, through banks, hopefully through local banks, to finance their projects and provide even greater economic stimulus and more commerce. In closing, I would respectfully urge this committee to give the Main Street Plan, and most importantly, the Oregonians it will put to work, serious consideration, and report House Bill 3095 out with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Chair, before I close, I have two quick items. There will be a Dash 1 amendment that will be offered, which we support.
We have that in front of us, actually.
We have it.
It makes a few technical changes to the bill that we did not have time ahead of this, so those are supported changes, and I could go through those, but if you have it, that's great. Second thing I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is you will have and receive today a number of pieces of written testimony. I want to read just two sentences from a piece of testimony coming from Tom Bryan, the chair of the Washington County Commission. And the first sentence I'd like to quote is, I am writing in support of House Bill 3095, the Main Street Incentive Program. And secondly, a tax credit like that proposed in House Bill 3095 will provide homeowners and businesses with the means to make important capital improvements to their valuable assets, stimulate our state's goal of expanding energy efficiency, and create family wage jobs. With that, Mr. Chair, written testimony has been provided, as has the letter from the Commission Chair. And with that, I would like to ask Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Leader. Representative Freeman.
Great. Thank you, Chair Reed and committee members. I appreciate you taking the chance today to listen to us. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman, and I represent House District 2. I do understand the committee is very busy, and I really do want you to know how much I appreciate you taking a chance to hear this. This entire concept or this idea came out of earlier in the session. We got to sit on the floor and we heard another stimulus package that came through. And there was a lot of testimony, and what I heard was, we need to do something. People are in bad shape. We got to figure out something to do. I believe there is going to be several things that we need to do, possibly many things we need to do, and this is just simply one of those things. This is just one good option. I want you to understand it's not the only option, and if we could get this one done, we can move on to the next one. I was sent to Salem by my constituents, and what they wanted for me when I was out knocking on doors was to help create jobs. We were already in tough economic times a year ago when I was knocking on doors in my area. Real quick, I represent parts of Douglas County, Josephine County, and Jackson County. Unemployment in Douglas County, as you heard earlier, is 18%, Josephine County 16.1%, and Jackson County 14%. People in my district are hurting. People in your districts are hurting. I don't have a lock on this. This is something that affects all of us, and we need to try to figure out many ways to help these people. This is one good one. There has been a little bit of talk already about this just being for the rich, and I want to take just a minute and talk about that. This is not just for the rich. It does not exclude the rich, but it's not just for the rich. The minimum qualifications to qualify for this program are you own property, whether it's residential or commercial, you have a tax liability, so that means you have a job, and you have access to capital. That means you either have a savings account or you can borrow money. There is a lot of people in our state that would qualify for this program that none of us would call rich. So I want to make sure that's clear to everybody. This helps a lot of people. And I do want to use a quick example, using the worst example I've heard so far, of a rich guy building a new pool at his house. And we think, boy, the last thing we want to do is let some rich guy build a pool at his house and use a tax credit. I want to talk about how that's really not that bad. Let's say a guy builds an $80,000 pool. Number one, he doesn't hire other rich people to do it. He hires somebody that needs a job and that is going to work hard and earn this money. Of his $80,000, only $50,000 will qualify under this program. Of that, only $25,000 will be taken as a tax credit. It will create jobs for pool builders company and his employees. It will create value that the local agency can tax and assess value and from now on. And the other thing it will create is a job for the guy maintaining the pool. So understand that even in the worst example that I've heard to date, it creates jobs and helps people that we're trying to help. So that's not the worst thing in the world. Real quick, I want to talk a little bit about the cost. And there will be lots of great people talk after me that can deal with this more. But people have to understand under this plan, there is no cost that isn't directly related to job creation. The amount of credits being claimed is going to be directly related to the number of projects being done. Therefore, the amount of money this project will cost the state is directly related to the job it creates. There's no overhead. We're not starting some big government agency that's going to have all this expense. It's a direct ratio. So if the numbers come true that we've got and it creates 6,000 jobs, great. If it doesn't create 6,000 jobs and it creates 100 jobs, great. If it creates 10,000 jobs, great. It's a direct ratio, and I think it's worthy of looking at. I have with us today County Commissioner Jora Lawrence, which is going to talk a little bit more about the county's perspective. I would urge you guys, and again, thank you for hearing, I would urge you to take a look at this today, try to pass it out of committee. I know it's a possible work session. I know I'm asking a lot, and I'd love to get this moving forward. And again, thank you for the time to speak to you today.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morse, Senate District 8, Albany and Corvallis area. And I am pleased to be here today to lend my support to this bill. We have, a penchant within this body to think big in terms of where we grant tax credits. And we have, over the years, have stimulated investments in major kinds of enterprises, and that's good. But where this bill, I think, really shines is it stimulates the enterprises in our communities that have been largely ignored in incentive processes that we have implemented. And I'd like to share with you the email that I received this morning from the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce. And we have many voices we listen to. These are the voices of the small communities, the small businesses that would be impacted if we implement this bill. And I might just add, the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce is, I believe, somewhat unique. They have about 30 people show up at 7 o'clock in the morning for their Governmental Affairs Committee. It's phenomenal, the interest they take. But they are throwing their support behind this bill because they see the storefronts going dark. They see the businesses laying off their employees. And I would just read into the record the testimony from the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce. On behalf of the Albany Area Chamber of Commerce, this is the President. I am pleased to give the Chamber's support to House Bill 3095, the Main Street Stimulus Plan. The Chamber's Governmental Affairs Committee reviewed the plan today and without hesitation gave its unanimous approval to this true stimulus plan for the following reasons, and you've heard those. Creation of jobs and income in our communities throughout the state. Increase in property values and subsequent increase in property tax revenues. And then the positive impacts that it provides to the financial institutions that would provide funds for the various projects that would be implemented. So, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, I'm delighted to be here with my colleagues at the table, and also with, I would consider, my colleagues in the business community that are here to testify as well. So thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Are there questions for the bill? None. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, as before with the other bills, far more people who have signed up to testify than I suspect we're going to be able to get through in the remaining minutes, so we'll do our best. I did note there was one person who has come from, or two people who have come from a great distance. Commissioner Lawrence, if you're here, please come forward. Commissioner Stewart, also beyond 100 miles, if you might come forward. And also, I guess I would invite Robert Whalen forward, if you'd like to join them. So, commissioners, you can decide to go first, please.
Mr. Chair, Reed, members of the committee, my name is Joe Lawrence, Douglas County Commissioner. Every person in this room has heard enough bad news in the last 6 months to last a lifetime. House Bill 3095, the Main Street Incentive Program, is the best news that I've heard in a long while. It means 6,000 jobs. It means increased property values of $250 million. I serve the citizens of Douglas County. As you've heard, our February unemployment rate was at 18%. The March unemployment figure is expected to be over 20%. Douglas County is a place where all property taxers pay for almost half, but not quite half, of just the Sheriff's Department. It's a county where measures 5 and 50 make an increase in taxation problematic. This bill offers hope to home builders of my county where some have taken their own lives out of desperation. House Bill 3095 offers hope as well to the timber industry facing the worst timber market that it has certainly seen in 25 years and perhaps 70 years, dating back to the summer of 1939. If this plan is not adopted only in Oregon, but other states as well, it would signal a change from bust to boom in my county and my state and perhaps the nation. That boom would save timber-dependent counties, governments, where timber net monies are set to expire in 4 years. About $5 million was spent in my county on 350 separate remodels last year in a county of only 105,000 total population. This bill provides a kickstart to our economy now with projects that will be started before this September. It takes us past a difficult short-term economic landscape. It helps Douglas County. It helps Oregon. It might help the nation. We ask your support for House Bill 3095, the Main Street Incentive Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Chair Reed and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Faye Stewart, Eastland County Commissioner. I'd like to start by saying that 2 weeks ago when I accepted this opportunity to speak, I felt I was going to be here speaking as an individual commissioner. But yesterday, the Board of Commissioners of Lane County voted unanimously to support House Bill 3095. Lane County residents, business, and government are all reeling from the events of last year. The expected loss of the federal forest payments and adoption of a budget that excluded the revenue. Subsequently, we received the funding, but at the amount that ramps down over the next 3 years to 40% of 1 year, and then is eliminated. A nationwide financial meltdown precipitated by extremely high gasoline prices and a loss of credit markets, and an employment rate that has now reached 12.8% in Lane County and expected to rise. This, in addition to the structural handcuffs that Lane County already has in place, simply put, counties have few tools to use to ensure a continuation of services that we provide to residents. Statutory preemptions exist with regard to construction excise taxes, utility right-of-way use, elections, and real estate transfers, to name a few. Measure 5 and 50 place limits on our abilities to raise property taxes. A land base limited by federal land and shrinking base tax base as cities expand. Here's why the Board of County Commissioners voted to support House Bill 3095. It supports and further incents green investments that long-term will help our residents and business save money. It will improve the overall value of real property improvements and business equipment, which will add to our property tax valuation. It will immediately stimulate both the construction and manufacturing sectors, which tend to be higher paying industries with better benefits for employees. It stimulates borrowing through community-based banks by individuals and businesses. Committee members, the stimulus package that this legislature passed early in the session was very likely necessary, and I don't doubt that it helped save existing jobs and created some new ones. But that money was invested mostly into projects that are not included on local tax rolls and thus provided little ongoing help to our local government. That money was invested in projects that were identified by the legislature as opposed to the residents and businesses of Oregon. And that money was bonded by the state, eroding the state's ability to bond future projects and limiting the ability to access revenue funds in an emergency. This proposal will also cost the state money in the form of avoided tax revenue. But in my estimation, it has a much better chance of returning the investment to the state and local governments through increased employment and capital improvements. It will give residents and businesses a unique opportunity to invest in their own future. And I urge you to please pass House Bill 3095.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Dr. Whalen?
Yes, I am an economist with 30 years of experience, and I've studied stimulus measures.
And if you wouldn't mind starting with your name for the record.
Oh, Robert Whalen.
Thanks very much.
Sorry. And I've studied stimulus packages most recently for a city in Oregon. And often people look at the benefits side. There are some negative impacts as well. And I just wanted to run by them. They should be considered. The benefits may exceed the negative impacts in this case, but I just want to run by them. People often don't think of these things. Now, the stimulus money comes from the federal government, and its money wouldn't have come to Oregon otherwise. The benefits are pretty clear. There are very few negatives with that. However, when you use a tax credit from the state, one of two things has to happen. Other people and businesses in the state have to make up that lost revenue, or the state has to cut spending. When you calculate the effect of that on jobs, it is substantial. $1 million worth of home construction in the state stimulates about 15 jobs, 15 years of jobs. $1 million in lost revenue of the state or higher taxes paid by individuals costs about 13 jobs. So you still come out ahead a little bit, but there is this large negative effect. However, because it's a tax credit, and because you deduct your Oregon income taxes from your federal taxes, your federal taxes increase. So there's a drawout, $1 million worth of tax credits, leads to about $350,000 in additional federal money going to the federal government, which is a negative impact on the state. That money comes out of the economy. That spending comes out of the economy. So there are trade-offs. Whether or not the construction, if it's housing, improves housing, generates future property taxes, those are longer-term benefits. They may exceed these negative effects, but they should be considered. It's very complicated. It's not as simple as let's induce people to spend more money and we'll have more jobs. It's not that simple.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. First, I want to acknowledge one of my county commissioners, Faye Stewart, and I have overlapping districts. They're not exactly contiguous, but we talk to a lot of the same a lot of the same voters. Very pleased to see you today, and pleased to hear that the commission has considered this bill. And then I have a question, if I may, for our economist,
Dr. Whalen. Yes,
Dr. Whalen. I wanted to make certain I understood the point you were making about the loss to the state. As now, I think what you were saying was that there's that when you give $1 million in tax credits, that has an effect on the state budget. Is that what you were referring to?
Well, you have less state revenue.
Less state revenue, and that reduces jobs in the state by 13.
Depends on how it's covered. If you maintain state spending otherwise, and you recover that money through higher revenues, whether it be taxes, fees, lottery, extra gaming, whatever extra revenues, $1 million in extra tax revenues, you raise taxes in the state by $1 million, it reduces the employment in the private sector by about 13 jobs.
Ah, thank you. So I did misunderstand what you said. I'm glad I asked. May I follow up?
Please.
Thank you. Do you know what the effect on the state budget is of $1 million?
In terms of employment?
Yes. When we have taxes and the tax money comes into the state, we spend it, of course, on the state programs. And that generates jobs as well.
Yeah, it's probably very close to the same amount. It's probably very close. It depends. Now, if it's health care, it's probably substantially more. Generally, state spending goes to labor costs, goes to a high labor component. So it has a pretty substantial impact.
Okay, and I guess I need to follow up again. When you say it goes to health care, it has a substantially greater impact. Why would that be?
Because much of the money goes to paying labor. $1 million in spending in general includes buying of goods and equipment as well as local labor. A lot of goods and equipment, I don't know, if I built a factory, I'd buy a lot of that equipment. Might come from New York State, might come from China. The lumber would come locally. That would benefit the economy directly here. The workers, they're almost all going to be local. That would benefit the economy here. But a lot of that money leaks out because you're spending it on purchases from outside the state.
Okay, and if I may, I thought you were going to say that healthcare actually results in more jobs because of the federal match. I assume that's also.
No, I didn't think of that, but you're right. That obviously, if there's a federal match, that's better.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Thatcher?
I just one quick question for the Mr. Whalen, Dr. Whalen, I guess. Did you look at the benefits of spreading out those decreases in revenue over 5 years? In other words, those tax credits are taken over a five-year period, if I understand the bill correctly.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I didn't study this bill specifically. I was asked by Representative Bailey to just come here and talk in general about the trade-offs of economic impacts of stimulus packages, because he knew I did that work recently. You know, there are all sorts of other factors to consider here. For instance, the improving property values obviously would help the counties. But then you have the opposite effect. You have excess supply of housing in Oregon right now. That's why we're in the economy we're in. So providing tax credits to add to the supply of housing, not necessarily beneficial.
Mr. Chair, I think it's improvements on existing properties.
Right. But if you have a household and you're expecting a new kid and you're looking, your choice is move to a larger house or can I expand my existing house, that could change the decision.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the clock, and I don't have a lot of time left, so I want to keep going. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Let's call Ms. Leachman, Emerson Smoker, is that right? And Laura Alexander, please.
I apologize if I got it wrong. That's
difficult reading, reading handwriting.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad I'm not the only one who has that problem.
that you are far from the only person.
Go ahead.
Please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Reed and members of the committee. My name is Emerson Smoker, Sr., and I am president of the Right Way Electric Company based in Albany, Oregon. We're a family-run electrical contractor, and we also have locations in McMinnville and in Silverton. I'm here today in support of the House Bill 3095 on behalf of our firm as well as the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon, of which we are a member. Like the other proponents of the legislation, we have noted this is the type of stimulus contractors, small businesses, and homeowners can use right now. Encouraging consumers to put money into their local economy in a way that will create and retain jobs, generate additional tax revenues, strengthen our economy, is a win-win-win proposition. There is enormous value in providing incentives included in this bill to homeowners and businesses in communities like Albany, McMinnville, Silverton, as well as Portland, Beaverton, Tigard, St. Helens, Eugene, Burns, and Kaiser, to help put money into our economy right now. From a construction contractor's perspective, I can tell you this is significant legislation for our industry. The provisions of this bill will provide homeowners and businesses an immediate incentive to spend capital they might not otherwise sit on because of the current economic situation. Cash is king right now, and this encourages those that have it to put it to work and to put Oregonians to work right now. As the former chairman of the Albany Chamber of Commerce, I am well aware of the multiplier effect that takes place when money is spent in our local economy. I've talked about it before with other business owners. When a homeowner enhances their property, that puts money in our electricians' pockets that they can go spend at the local restaurant. Then the staff at the local restaurant spends that same money again at our local grocery store, and so on and so on.
Mr. Smoker, can I ask you to wrap up? I'm just looking at the clock and seeing the next committee kind of lurking. I want to make sure we get as many
voices sure
as we can in the last bit.
I'd like to give you just an example. We have been wanting to put a solar system on the roof of our business and of our home. Because of this present situation, we have not been able to do that. This stimulus, I hate to call it stimulus, but this package would allow us to do that. So I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming for your testimony. Mr. Leachman.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leachman. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3095. In particular, I want to focus on the jobs claims that have been attached to House Bill 3095. I don't believe that the bill would actually have the level of impact on the economy or on jobs that proponents claim. The first reason is that many of the projects that would receive tax breaks under this bill would happen anyway. Think, for example, about a project that started in January of this year. It's unlikely that taxpayers who undertook those projects did so because they expected the legislature to cover the state to cover half or all of the cost. And it's not just projects that started earlier this year that would benefit, even though they would have happened anyway. I know this from my personal experience. I'm actually personally considering a remodel of my house, and it appears that that remodel would be eligible for a 50% credit under this bill. That would be helpful to me, but I would have done the project anyway. The jobs that have been claimed to be connected with the tax break, however, include projects that have already occurred or this year or would have occurred anyway over the next few months. The second reason has been already touched on. The proponents say that it will cost $45 million a year over the next 5 years. That money is likely to come from a further reduction in state services. And sometimes we think about the public sector as somehow operating in a different universe from the economy, but in fact, the public sector is a vital part of the economy. And state government spending circulates in Oregon communities through Medicaid funds received by private hospitals, for example, through financial support received by families in need of public assistance, through government contracts given to private companies, through the paychecks of public employees who spend that money on private goods and services right here in Oregon. So when we cut public sector spending, those cuts have an impact on the state economy. And as Representative Barnhart mentioned, the impact of those cuts are magnified by the fact that state spending often attracts federal matching money. Health care or Medicaid spending was mentioned. The federal government more than matches our state Medicaid spending, and that's particularly true given the federal stimulus package, for example, because the federal stimulus package is offering additional incentives to states. For example, in the TANF program, the federal government is offering, through the stimulus package, a 4-to-1 match for TANF spending over a base period. It appears to be what we spent in 2007. So if we increase our TANF spending, we'll get most of that money back from, or we'll get a 4-to-1 match from the federal government. So, but the jobs numbers that have been connected to this bill don't count the fact that we would very likely see public sector spending cuts, and that will result in job losses both in the public and the private sector. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Leachman. Ms. Alexander, we have just a couple minutes. I'd love to hear from you.
Hi, my name is Laura Alexander. I work for a general contractor.
And if you might just move the microphone a little bit farther away, it'll distort less. Sorry. Thank you.
My name is Laura Alexander, and I work for a general contractor, and we build commercial industrial buildings and many schools throughout Oregon. I was listening to your testimony, and I believe that in commercial real estate, I think the tax deduction is 33% for improvements, but if it's residential, you don't get a tax deduction because it is associated with improving the property, so it's a gain rather than a loss. But in regards to the construction industry as a whole, the unemployment rate right now is very high, and right now they have a reported rate in the newspaper at 10.8, and I believe it's much higher amongst the construction trades. I receive calls every day from contractors looking for work and from individual carpenters looking for work as well, union and non-union. I also talked to numerous real estate agents prior to today's visit, and what they said is that the new listings is down by 38%. That means that those potential sellers are staying in their homes and improving their homes to a standard that is more suitable for their current living condition. I believe that this House bill would promote new construction within those homes. And then in regards to commercial real estate, I have a letter right here. I have brought enough copies for all of you. It's in regards to potential property buyer, and he owns a restaurant called the Oswego Lake House out in Lake Oswego, and he's considering purchasing the theater next door. He put off his project, which is going to be in excess of $700,000 because of the economy, and his letter here clearly says that if this passes, it'll be an easier move for him because although he may incur great losses the first year, he can recoup it tax-wise and be able to absorb some of those costs in the short run.
Thank you, Ms. Alexander. In the very short period of time we have remaining before the next committee storms the room, are there any questions for this panel? Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're out of time, and obviously we're not going to go to a work session, so I want to make sure I'm on record thanking you very much for hearing this today, because I know we got a full agenda, and I want to thank our revenue chair for taking the time to be here, because I sit on other committees and I know he's got other stuff to do. So thank you both very much.
Thank you, Representative.
You know, just to the point, Mr. Leachman, you don't have to respond, but I note that your the motto here is because facts matter. I got to point out to you that I think you were claiming that proponents came up with the job figures in this. and it's from an independent analysis, not from the proponents. So I agree, facts matter, and I just wanted to clear that up.
Thank you. Any last questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Leachman.
Chair Reed, Representative Gillum. I appreciate that. I was referring to press releases released in regarding the bill. I understand that the measure, that the numbers were developed by Leslie Revenue Office.
Good. Thank you very much. Appreciate everyone being here. We've obviously run out of time. We'd welcome any written testimony that people have to submit, and appreciate your time. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3095 and adjourn the committee.
Better.